Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
Good afternoon. I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And there's a lot we are going to talk about today. And as I said earlier, at the end of the second hour, we're going to be talking with Congressman Elijah Cummings about Ron Walters, who headed the Institute for African American Leadership at the University of Maryland College Park, who passed away. And many of us didn't even know he was that ill. He was only 72. And one of the great leaders who ran Jesse Jackson's both campaigns for Jesse Jackson. Which I just learned that my friend, colleague, dear friend Anthony McCarthy, worked on the first campaign right out of high school.
Yeah.
You were on his advance team.
On the advance team, traveled all over the country, making way for Reverend Jackson to sweep into town and wow everybody. It was exciting. Great learning experience.
And we'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about the life of Erwin Silber, who was the founder of a magazine called Sing Out. But he was a radical figure in American politics. Who stood up for African-American community and many other things in his time and was a founder of the great folk music magazine. And we'll talk about all that in the next hour. But for now, we're going to talk about politics on the ground here in the state of Maryland and Baltimore City and around
some
the country.
Some heat being generated around heat the city of Baltimore, some races in the state legislature and, of course, citywide.
And we're joined to help us out in this conversation by Brian Griffiths, who is contributing editor to Red Maryland, which is the conservative Red Scare, not the left-wing Red Scare. Brian, how are you? Welcome, my friend.
Always very exciting. The last 24 hours heading into any sort of election. It's going to be a long night for me and a lot of other folks tonight, but it's all well worth it to be part of the political process.
And we will talk about that and what you'll be watching. Michael Johnson should be here in a minute, founder and executive director of the Paul Robeson Institute. And the number here is 410-319-8888. Let me ask you, Anthony, one of the things you said to me in the green room, and I don't know if this is a race you're following or not, Brian, but one of our local races, before we talk about Pat Jessamy and Greg Bernstein, which is in the terms of Baltimore City, is the race I think people are looking at.
Most definitely.
Is the race for state senate between Della and
Bill Ferguson.
Bill Ferguson.
Over in the 46th district.
South Baltimore.
And it covers all of the city's waterfront from west all the way across to east. It was at one time, Mark, one of the most blue-collar districts we have in the city of Baltimore. It certainly has changed. A lot of middle-class, young professionals, D.C. Implants to the city of Baltimore, transplants to the city of Baltimore have moved into that Canton, Fells Point area, as well as parts of Federal Hill. And it is a fascinating race. George Della has served more than 20 years in the state Senate. He is one of the longest serving legislators in the history of our city and in the history of the state. He does not chair any major committees, which his opponent has pointed out. For someone who has served that long, he does it. On the surface, doesn't seem to have amassed much influence and power. But
he has lots.
I was going to say, make no mistake, George Della is one of the most influential legislators in the state of Maryland. He is being challenged by a 27-year-old teacher who came to Baltimore several years ago, less than 10 years ago, as a Teach for America teacher from Washington, D.C. And it is amazing when you look at how much fire has been generated in this district. This 27-year-old teacher was a classroom teacher, then became a special assistant to our CEO of our public schools, has really been able to raise a lot of issues, attract a lot of development money, as well as other young professionals have really latched onto his campaign, and has made this an extraordinarily competitive race. And so he was endorsed by the Baltimore Sun. Bill Ferguson was endorsed by the city paper. Now, really, as someone who's run for office in this city and has worked on campaigns in this city, endorsements mean very little other than for the energy and morale of a campaign. But he has really been able, and I will tell you, I talked to a couple of pundits, talked to some folks who've been watching that race from Hopkins and University of Maryland, and they say it's a toss-up. They believe that George Della could, in fact, be unseated by Bill Ferguson.
That's a rarity in
so rare in the
Maryland
city of
politics, in Baltimore City especially.
Baltimore City especially.
Della is powerful. I mean, you've got the economic powerhouse of South Baltimore, Pat Turner.
Almost definitely.
The developer who is dying to get Della out of office.
Has contributed the limit he contributed to Bill Ferguson. Has taken out full-page advertisements in the local papers along the waterfront, including the Baltimore Guide, blasting George Della, raising some ethical questions about George Della. But really, it's one of those things, Mark, where The Baltimore Sun especially contrasted this as old Baltimore politics plus a new generation of politics. Bill Ferguson working the internet, going a classic by-the-book campaign, identifying super voters. George Della, a door-by-door, handshaking, old-style Baltimore politician. But it has been extraordinarily effective, and it may be, again, be the saving grace. He connects. He also, I mean, to give everybody their own props, George Della has an extraordinary reputation for constituent service. His constituents, when they call his office, they usually get him. They don't get a secretary or someone else. And so he has really for generations connected with voters.
He is the old style Paul, and he's from the roots of the old South Baltimore politics. When
his father,
Soft Shoes McGurk, and the others were running that place, the Stonewall Democratic Club, he comes from that whole era. And this could be interesting to watch what happens with this. I mean, I've heard you were telling me about some people commenting, you know, that how can a 27-year-old, somebody in their 20s, be—
This was an elected official who said this to me.
And the question is, how can they not be? We need young people. Not that I'm endorsing. I'm just—
Of course.
It could be anybody, but because I've been following this race. And have you been following this race at all, Brian?
Yeah, I have been. I have a lot of friends who live up in that area, particularly in the Canton area and the Brewers Hill area, and a lot of them are transplants from Frederick or upstate New York or Philadelphia or Virginia, or people who've moved here in the last 5 years, and you know, people who really are not in tune with the history of the Della machine, the history of Baltimore City politics. But one of the ways a lot of them got introduced to Senator Della was last year. You know, the name was not very, you know, very widely publicized among them, but then last year he introduced the legislation in the General Assembly that would have outlawed beer pong.
That's right.
And the news of that spread like wildfire, and it really, a lot of folks that I know got real exercised about that and called the senator's office and emailed his office about, you know, about the beer pong ban that was proposed. And I think nothing kind of signifies the generation gap potentially between Senator Della and these primary voters than that one bill. I think that he's in serious trouble.
And not only is he in serious trouble, and I really appreciate Brian's perspective on that, but he is running his normal slate of Brian Hammond and Delegate McHale, whose first name escapes me for some reason. And he's running an attorney named Luke Clippinger. Now, if Luke Clippinger is elected, it's something that they haven't talked about in the campaign at all. Luke Clippinger is openly gay. He has been endorsed by the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund and others. But if he's elected, he joins a very small number of openly gay legislators, and he's running an extraordinarily interesting district where, as Brian said and I said and you acknowledge, there is a different demographic now that may be the deciding factor, and that's these transplants into South Baltimore. That will, it's a very, for those of us who love politics and watch local politics, it's a very interesting race because Brian McHale may, in fact, be the lower man in those incumbents who may get pushed out because there are three or four other very serious contenders running in that race. That district really could change. Caroline Kruziak is not running for reelection.
And not to always put it in terms of race, but
of
I'm
course.
Going to anyway. for the new politics of young white Baltimore voters in these new areas, because most of those people who live in that districts are young white professionals who moved in and creating a whole new Baltimore in downtown. This could be a sea change in terms of the politics of Baltimore. Could set to where part of the future of politics are going.
And Mark, those same voters that we're talking about, for those people, you know, and we're going to talk about this race in a little bit. But those are that's the same demographic that Pat Jessamy has been working here in the last couple of weeks. She appeared in Canton. She's been knocking on doors, campaigning in those districts.
Right.
And certainly, if you live in Canton, Federal Hill, Brewers Hill, the plethora of Greg Bernstein signs that you see throughout these young white professional neighborhoods is a really interesting turn of events and political development in Baltimore.
We have with us Brian Griffiths is one of our guests here, editor of a contributing editor of Red Maryland, I asked a couple other people to call in. Sherilyn Ifill just wrote me an email. She may be calling in to talk about her editorial in this morning's paper about the Jessamy Bernstein race. We're supposed to be talking with Pat Jessamy and Greg Bernstein in the course of the hour. We've asked them both to call in. Greg Bernstein said he would, and Pat Jessamy's campaign said that she would probably call in. I hope she does, to have time to come. One last brief conversation with both of them before this race. And the other day when I was at the grocery store, I ran into Anthro Pietola, who is one of Guatemala's great writers. We had him on here for his recent
extraordinary
book,
writer.
Editorial writer for The Sun for many years, who knows his politics. And he said to me in the checkout line that he thought that this could be one of the third most important political race in the history of Baltimore.
Wow.
And Anthro, I asked him to call in. He's here now. Anthro, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Well, good afternoon, Mark. Good afternoon, Anthony.
Hey, if I knew you were already on the line, I'm not sure I would have called you such an extraordinary writer. I wouldn't want you to think I was pandering to you.
Well, I mean you can. I don't know whether you guys agree, but it seems to me that only in half a dozen cases has Baltimore's black electorate formed a united front. The first time, of course, it happened in 1954. Black Democrats united behind a Republican, Harry Cole. This effort defeated Jack Pollock's white machine and made Cole the first African-American state senator in Maryland history. The second time came after the 1968 riots. The citywide electorate at the time was 48% black. It united behind the lawyer Joseph Howard, who challenged and beat a sitting judge and thereby became the first African-American to sit on the municipal court hearing criminal felony cases. Shortly thereafter, 40 years ago this year, Milton Allen was elected the city's first African-American state's attorney and the first black prosecutor in any major American city. And this activism also led to the election of Perrin J. Mitchell as the first African-American congressman in Maryland's history. So it seems to me that this may be, just maybe, in the similar league. And what I think is kind of interesting is that Pat Jessamy, as a prosecutor, has lots of enemies. And as an incumbent, she has to be a very weak incumbent. But to see the black community rallying behind her this strongly, it's a very interesting spectacle. And the last comment I'm going to make is this, that this kind of is interesting also that there is another very important race, and it has really gotten very little attention, and that is the sheriff race. The sheriff, John Anderson, the incumbent, has been under lots of criticism, and there is a very good challenger, Lieutenant Deborah Clarity, who actually works in the sheriff's department, and we have not really heard anything about this race.
Well, I've had all the candidates, with the exception of John Anderson for sheriff, on my show twice. And there is, Antero said, a very interesting race. John Anderson has served more than 15 years, if not longer, actually, maybe even up to 20 years, as the city sheriff. He's being challenged by the woman who was in charge of human resources in his office, Lieutenant Deborah Clarity. He's also being charged, challenged by one of his former lieutenants, Francis Jean Hamilton, as well as one or two other candidates. Some of those candidates have dropped out of the race, two of them, and endorsed Gene Hamilton because they thought there were too many people in the race to challenge him. He's come under fire for his management of that office, some budget issues, overtime issues, allegations of discrimination against women. You and I both, Mark, know John Anderson, know him very well, but this race could be blown out of the water, and as Antero said, one that a lot of people haven't been paying attention to. But on the whole, Mark, when you talk to people, and I've talked to people in grocery stores and restaurants, they weren't even familiar with the fact that we had a sheriff in the city of Baltimore,
right?
Or what the duties of the sheriff is. I found out on this past Friday when I had the candidates on the show, the only qualifications be 25 and have lived in the city for a year, and you can run for sheriff of the city of Baltimore. And obviously the sheriffs protect the court staff and the judges. They provide security at our courthouses, and they serve warrants and monitor evictions.
And I have to say before I make any comments on that, I must have a little disclaimer that 20 some years ago I ran a campaign against John Anderson. It lost. Every campaign I've ever run has lost.
Run.
That's right. That's what Antero said. All your campaigns.
Oh my God, it's true. Every campaign I've ever run has lost. So don't hire him as your campaign manager, ever.
But this, Mark, if let's say John Anderson was defeated, let's say, and this is certainly in no way any kind of prediction or making an endorsement or judgment, but if John Anderson is turned out of office and Senator Dellos turned out of office and one or two of our sitting delegates are turned out, and there is a possibility with
Kiefer Mitchell's campaign
and others, Rodney Burris in, I forget, Joan Carter Conway's district, 45th, I think. There are some really strong candidates. It would be one of the first times, Mark, that we have seen change in some of these districts in generations. The machines in those individual districts, the power of those senators in those individual districts usually rule the day. Now, some people are even saying, Mark, I wish I knew Joan Carter Conway's district. She's being challenged by a gentleman named Hector Torres.
That's right.
Who is a former spokesperson for the chief in our fire department, a former spokesperson for our fire department. Some people are saying that polling numbers show that although it would be a long shot, a very big long shot, that Hector Torres is making headway, inroads in that district. So there is this feeling, and I wonder if Brian has noticed this around the state, as a matter of fact, that incumbents, even if they're not in trouble, incumbents are really having to campaign hard and work hard.
Well, I'll tell you what, out here in Anne Arundel County, in my legislative district, District 31, the incumbents so far have been kind of taking a wait-and-see, you know, approach where they some of them have been out there doing their normal thing, and some of them have been sitting back resting on their laurels.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that, of course, has not stopped challengers from coming at them full gun blazing. So I think that, you know, there's even out here in the county on Republican primaries and Democratic primaries, there's a little bit of an undercurrent that incumbents could go down. What we're seeing in the broader spectrum of things is that, you know, incumbency is not what it once was. And, you know, we could see there are always one or two seats every year where an incumbent goes down in the primary and none of us saw it coming. So, you know, and I know, you know, you talked about Hector Torres. I know he's been out there and really working the stumps. So it would be a shock if he did pull off that upset. But, you know, at the same time, it wouldn't be as much of a shock as some other things, too. Incumbents who are not out there working the stump and working hard for their reelection do so at their own peril, just given this electoral environment this year.
I'm curious, Brian, on another race that we probably are going to get to talk about, maybe some of our callers will be talking about. Bob Ehrlich is being challenged, and we haven't really talked about this very much. He's being challenged in the primary by Murphy. I forget his first name off the top. Brian Murphy.
Right.
One of my friends texts me just now during the show saying that he got a robocall. He's a registered Republican. He just got a robocall from Sarah Palin saying to show up tomorrow to vote for Brian Murphy over former Governor Bob Ehrlich. Is there any scenario, Brian, that you see Murphy being able to overcome Bob Ehrlich?
No, there's absolutely no way. And interest of full disclosure, Red Maryland has endorsed Bob Ehrlich. I'm working for the Ehrlich campaign. But, the polling, the last poll that was done was the Center Maryland poll, which is of questionable veracity. it had Murphy polling of 13%. I talked with a member of the General Assembly yesterday who told me that there was a poll that was done in a local race that got a sense of a conservative district Republican likely voters, what they were going to do in the primary, and Murphy was polling at 2%.
Wow.
So now I don't think that he's going to get 2%. I think that anything, Murphy doesn't probably crack 20% at all. The interesting number to me, and I wrote about this on Red Maryland this morning, is the voter discontent in the Democratic Party with Martin O'Malley. Murphy does not have a snowball's chance of beating Bob Ehrlich, but to his credit, he has raised about $300,000. He has gone from one side of the state to the other, campaigning for this seat. So he's actually put in the effort to go ahead and campaign. Martin O'Malley has two Democratic challengers in this primary who, of course, have not done any campaigning really whatsoever. And the interesting thing is going to be, you know, a lot of people have talked about whether or not Brian Murphy crosses the Fustero line, named after Bob Fustero, who got 20% of the vote in the primary against Kathleen Kennedy Towns in 2002. The interesting number to me tomorrow is not going to be what Brian Murphy gets, but the combined total of what O'Malley's challengers did in the Democratic primary. And I think that those two folks could approach that 20% mark against Martin O'Malley tomorrow, despite the fact that they've done no campaigning.
Well, we'll see. I mean, they might. I mean, there's a lot of dissatisfaction there, but we'll see. That it'll be interesting to watch how that happens. I'm really curious to see how those results come in. Antoine, let's talk a bit about the Pat Chesimee and Greg Bernstein race here, and as one of the most significant races in the last 30, 40 years. And I thought it was very interesting. I'd forgotten all about it until you said to me that this is the 40th.
Yeah, I did.
40 years after Milton Allen won his race.
And, of course, Milton Allen then in the next election in 1974 was defeated by a white candidate connected with the Pollock machine. So I mean, these go in cycles. Now, let me just say one thing about this Jesse Bernstein race, which I think is very interesting. It seems to me that lots of Baltimore voters have a real conflict with their self-interest. There are lots of people who hate crime and want strict prosecution, but ours is a city where lots of residents are somehow entangled in the criminal justice system. And I just wonder whether many voters also take into account the fact that if their husband, a daughter, brother, or sister gets caught and ends up in a system which doesn't deliver a predictable outcome, well, the system seems to work for them.
Let me deposit this. What you just raised, Antoine, I hope that Sherilyn has a chance to call in, because she's going to try to, but I know she's teaching. But what she said in her op-ed piece today is what I've been thinking a lot about, which is that we put a lot at the doorstep of the state's attorney's office in fighting crime. And I really wonder, in all sincerity, whether no matter who is elected state's attorney, if it'll make any difference at all in terms of the crime rate or crime in Baltimore. Crime has been going down in Baltimore. Unless you are living in poor neighborhoods and you don't think it's going anywhere, and if you live in upper middle class neighborhoods, then you think crime is going up when somebody gets attacked and murdered, but it's not. And so I just wonder where we all think about this. I mean, and what this campaign comes down to. And one of the bottom line here is one of the things I think Bernstein's campaign doesn't get in this city we have now is that if you're black and in Baltimore, whether you are a physician living in Guilford or a working or unemployed and living on Guilford Avenue, your interactions with the police there's always been some trouble along the way that I think Jesimee taps into and Bernstein does not, that kind of grit. And I just wonder what you all think along those lines. And we have joining us now Michael Johnson, made his way through traffic, and Sherilyn Eiffel joins us by phone. Michael, why don't you comment fast, then we'll go to Sherilyn.
Well, I think you're absolutely right when you suggest that, there's a tale of two cities here. And if there's a tale of two cities, there's also a tale of two types of representation. I think to suggest that the state's attorney's office is the office who can solve crime is to suggest that crime begins. Really, in the state's attorney's office. I mean, crime in the community begins from problems that exist in the community. The end result is the police department and the state's attorney. I don't expect the police department to end the shootings. They are mop-up team, in all honesty. They get there after it's been done. Now, yeah, they can concentrate on a lot of the areas that have it's always funny to me when you hear a story that says a known drug area. Well, if you know it, I don't think that the crime really ends in the state's attorney's office. I think what they have a tendency to do.
But now, let's bring Sherilyn up after the break, because we're running out of time. She has a lot to say, so we don't want to cut her off.
Very brief break. And Antoine, I understand you have to run.
Okay.
It's always great to have you on the show. We're looking forward to having you back soon.
Good luck.
But let me say this one thing real quick, Mark, before we go to the break. A lot of people, mayors, city council members, a lot of people have been taking credit for the drop in crime in this city for years. I mean, from Martin O'Malley, Sheila Dixon, Stephanie Rawlings Blake. It is very interesting to me that when Pat Jessamy starts talking about a drop in crime, it is disputed. And not only is it disputed, but people tell her she shouldn't take credit for it. Where we have really made decisions about who's been an effective mayor, effective city council president, and other positions, and police commissioners. We have fired police commissioners because of this so-called not being able to control crime. So it's very interesting how this has played out. And I think Sherilyn's going to tell us there's a racial dynamic to it.
Anthony McCarthy and I will be right back with our guests, including Michael Johnson, Brian Griffiths, and Sherilyn Eiffel's just called in. 410-319-8888, and Greg Bernstein has just called in. So we have a lot to talk about and many people to talk with. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We are joined for the rest of this half hour. Michael Johnson's in the studio, founder and executive director of the Paul Robeson Institute. Brian Griffiths continues to join us, contributing editor of Red Maryland. Sherilyn Eiffel, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, who just wrote an op-ed piece about this election, joins us by phone. He called in after I wrote to her, after reading her editorial too late in the day to call her early in the morning to make sure she could come on, but she called in anyway. And we're joined by also Greg Bernstein, who is a candidate for Baltimore City State's Attorney, and hope soon to hear from Pat Jessamy as well. So which way should we do this? Greg, you called in. How much time do you have with us, Greg?
Well, I'm on for a few minutes. You asked me to call in, Mark, and so I called in.
Great. So let me do this, if I might. We've asked Sherilyn just to Sherilyn, I want you to, and Greg Bernstein might want to comment on what you were talking about, what you kind of laid out in your op-ed piece, and if you would just talk a bit about that to those who haven't read or don't read The Sun.
Well, the point of the piece was to hope that everyone would take a deep breath before tomorrow, because like I think Michael Johnson was your guest, who said this, I've been so distressed, and I think I used the term in the piece, dispirited, by the tenor of the state's attorney's race over the last, week or so. And in particular, just really kind of came to a head over the last 4 days with some of the things that were reported in The Sun and said in The Sun. And, you know, the part that I think has gotten lost in this, you know, two things that I tried to write about. One is that, we ought not be afraid to admit that there was no question that race was going to come up as an issue in this race, not simply because Pat Jessamy is black and because Greg Bernstein is white, but simply because issues of crime and punishment in the city always have a racial dynamic to them. And I think some of those things are worth talking about. They're actually relevant and important, and I tried to talk about some of that in the piece about, you know, the issue of, you know, prevention and drug addiction and the debilitation of communities in Baltimore that really suffer from not only large amounts of crime, but also, criminal defendants who end up in jail, who come back to the community, who cycle in and out of the community, and how debilitating that is for families and institutions in the community. So we have to talk about that. We have to talk about how jurors respond to police testimony. That's an issue that's been talked about over the years, that it relates to this whole issue of conviction rates and so forth. We can't pretend that those things don't have some racial dynamic. There's a responsible way, I think, to talk about those things. So I think that's important. Then the second piece is the piece that Michael Johnson raised, which is that I've heard in this contest from too many commentators, a view that suggests that the state's attorney's office is now kind of the be-all and end-all of Baltimore's crime problem. And in the piece I wrote today, I said that I really feel like a shift happened in the city in our conversation after the murder of Stephen Pitcairn, because it was such a tragic event that struck a chord, not unrelated to his race and not unrelated to the fact that he's a student at Johns Hopkins and so forth, but many of us felt very tragically implicated by his murder. And so there is no question that we've had some kind of change, some kind of shift. But my fear is that that shift has led us to an almost kind of hysteria about what the state's attorney's office does and can do. It's a key part of the criminal justice system. It's a key part of crime and punishment. It's a key part of keeping our cities safe. But as other callers have mentioned, so is the mayor's office. If we were talking about some, you know, contentious judicial race, we would be saying it was all about the judges and their sentencing practices. You know, we can't simply suggest that this all falls into any one office or indeed to public office as the be-all and end-all at all, because a lot of it begins in our own communities. And I identified in the piece that I wrote today some of the things that we've talked about over the years in Baltimore City as the cause of our criminal crime problem. We've talked about education. We've talked about corruption in the police department. We've talked about zero-tolerance policing in the past. We've talked about juror response to police testimony. We've talked about the stop-snitching culture. We've talked about truth in sentencing. We've talked about so many things. And yet somehow in the last 8 weeks, we've made it as though all of that stuff's irrelevant. And the only thing that actually decides what our crime and justice figures look like is the state's attorney's office. And I just think that's a mistake.
I think, Greg Bernstein, I appreciate you calling in. And we do hope that after you call in, that we also hear from the woman who wants to keep her job. If you would kind of comment on what you just heard, what do you think about the state of how we look at this race that you are in the middle of, obviously?
Well, Mark, I have said from the beginning when I first announced, and I've said it consistently and repeatedly, that I think that issues of public safety transcend race. I think they transcend socioeconomic status. I think they transcend gender, age, and the like. And I have said, and if you go back and look at the earlier articles when I was interviewed and I was asked the same question about issues of race, I've always said that I think that the people of Baltimore are more concerned about issues of public safety than they are about race and racial politics, and I give them more credit than that. And actually, what I said back in July, I think, has been proven by what I've seen as I've gone throughout the city, knocking on doors, talking to people everywhere. And I mean everywhere. I mean, I've been to places like Shipley Hill and Beachfield. I was in Perkins Homes a couple weeks ago, and I know that many of your listeners know the kinds of neighborhoods that I'm talking about. And I go into those neighborhoods and I speak to the people there, and they tell me that they feel no safer now than they did 15 years ago, that they are tired and they're frustrated by the crime, and that they're ready for change. And many of them say to me that I'm the first person that's ever walked through their neighborhood and knocked on their doors and spoken to them. And they don't talk to me about race. They don't talk to me about the color of my skin or the color of Mrs. Jessamy's skin. I mean, they just talk about their fear and frustration about crime. And I think that notwithstanding what, you know, may or may not, the way in which people may try to portray it, that's not the way that I portrayed it. I mean, I certainly think that issues of drug addiction and the like and what happens to individuals who go back into the community who have drug addictions are important issues. And I think that to the extent that there are people who have drug addiction issues, who commit nonviolent crimes, they need to be treated in a way that's different from locking them up and letting them sit in Baltimore City Jail for 3 or 4 months before their trial comes up. I've said that repeatedly. To me, the issue is focusing on the violent crime. And while certainly, and I've said this repeatedly, that the state's attorney's office is only one part of this system, and that there are judges, there is parole and probation, there is police, there are many, many components to the criminal justice system. And the state's attorney's office, to use Ms. Iffel's, Professor Iffel's words, she's right. It's not the end-all, be-all. But what I say is that the system is dysfunctional, and it's not working. And the numbers and the statistics, I mean, we can batter them about all we want, but the fact of the matter is Baltimore remains one of the most dangerous places in America to live. And it has remained that way for the last 15 years. And what I say is that it has to start somewhere, and that someone has to say, I'm going to try to step up, step in and try to make a difference. And at least if I can do a better job in the state's attorney's office, it might then improve the other parts of the criminal justice system as well.
Greg, I want to add, this is Anthony McCarthy. I want to ask you, Professor Ifill made a very interesting point, two very interesting points about some of the, I guess, the hurdles, whether it comes, whether it's our jury system and the reluctance of our juries when it comes to conviction, when it comes to some of the evidence that's gathered by the police department, that an argument can be made that these assistant state's attorneys have some weak evidence gathered, weak investigations gathered from these police officers. If you become state's attorney, you're going to have those same hurdles. You're going to have juries that are not inclined to believe police officers, are not inclined to convict. And I hate to make blanket statements, but I want to get to this point real quick. And you'll have the same police officers who are doing, unless things have changed, they're doing really lackluster jobs in some cases at bringing evidence that is able to force a conviction. How do you change that? I mean, how could that be any different than what Ms. Jessamy's been facing for 15 years?
Well, Anthony, let me respond to that. I think, first of all, I do not accept the notion that Baltimore City juries are incapable of finding defendants guilty of serious violent crime when a well-prepared and well-presented case is put before them. I mean, I have friends who are judges. I have one close friend who's a judge who told me recently he had six or seven acquittals in a row. And you know what he said to me? He said, Greg, it's not the juries. He said, I would have found these defendants not guilty. He said, it's the way in which the evidence is being presented. And what a major component of my plan is, once I become next state's attorney, is to institute very programmatic training programs for the young state's attorneys, using both people within the office and outside in the private sector, other trial lawyers like myself who have agreed to participate in these programs to make the state's attorneys more effective in their presentations. Now, with respect to the way in which the evidence is gathered by law enforcement, certainly there are issues there, as there are issues with respect to the way that the state's attorneys are presenting their cases. But I think if you also help to participate in the training of the officers and teach them more about the constitutional amendments and what they have to do to prepare for trial, I think you're going to get a better prepared case. You don't have a prepared case when the police officer comes into court on the morning of trial and says to the state's attorney for the first time, here I am, and the state's attorney puts the officer on the stand and says, where were you on the night of October 18th? And the officer starts to look at his notes because he can't remember. Mm. That's not an effective presentation. That leads to mistakes being made, or if you want to, you know, take it to the extreme, statement misrepresentations being made. But if you're preparing the officers on the front end, that's when you start to have effective presentations. And finally, Anthony, with regard to your last point, there is an issue with respect to witnesses. But what I say about witnesses, I don't think it is a stop snitching mentality. I think it is a fear of snitching mentality, because I believe strongly that witnesses are afraid to testify because they are not confident that the state's attorney's office and the police are going to be able to convict the defendants. And I think once you can improve on that and they start to get confidence in your ability to obtain convictions, I think that's when you start to get better testimony from witnesses. Now, finally,
well,
I would...
Greg, let me just say, I'm only interrupting you just because we have very little time, and I know you don't have much time. And we have two other people here on the panel, and Sherilyn's on the phone. We have people calling in. Some have had other comments to make. Some of whom want to ask you a question. And if State Attorney Jessamy does call in, then we're going to have to go to her. So it just want to let you... This is the parameters of our last 18 minutes.
Well, thanks, so, Mark, I get it. You asked me to call in, so I called in.
No. This is great. I want you to, but I'm just saying, in terms of time, I want to give everybody a chance to kind of, while you're here with us, ask a question and have you answer it and respond to them. That's why I was saying what I was saying. We did ask you to call in. We deeply appreciate that you have called in. And it means a lot to the citizens of Baltimore and the people who are voting in the election tomorrow. Quick question from over here.
Yeah, this is Mike Johnson from the Paul Robeson Institute. I mean, I think I find it really difficult when someone suggests that crime and justice is not black and white. I have big problems with that. I know what people are saying in the community, because I've been in the Shipley Hills and all of the places that you've been with other elected officials. I assure you, you're not the first person to get to these places. Now, maybe the first person that these new people have seen before. Historically, you're not. But at the same time, when we suggest that crime and justice is not black and white, is not to talk about the reality of it. The reality is that we have a miseducation in our school system. We have large percentages of black men who are in the jails. I mean, a huge percentage of African-American men and women that are in jail and that are in the court systems. So for us not to suggest that this is not a black and white issue is to suggest that, you know, there's no air.
Well, wait, did you have a question, though?
Well, like, I mean, no, I had a comment to the comment because I think I find it really difficult when someone can pander and suggest that at the same time that this is not a racial issue. Crime and justice is a racial issue.
Greg, I think we allow Greg to respond to that.
No, Mike. I understand what he was saying. And Mike, look, I can't stress this strongly enough. I mean, you may simply not, you know, agree with me, but I would hardly use the word pandering. I mean, I don't think that's appropriate at all. I mean, I think we're trying to have a frank discussion here about the issues. And what I'm talking about is people's fear of crime and their concern that public safety is one of the most important issues or most important rights, I think, that people have, and they just don't feel safe in their neighborhoods. Now, that is separate and apart from, to me, the issue of race and crime, because I agree with you, Mike, 100%. I think that the studies have shown universally that it really does in many ways begin with education, and to the extent that the educational system can be improved, and to the extent that we can reach young juveniles at ages 8, 9, 10, and even earlier, that we will have a marked impact on our ability to stop crime in this city, where by setting up aftercare programs, early education, helping parents to understand better how to parent their children. I'm sure you're aware of the study that says that's found that there's a direct correlation between the amount of vocabulary that young kids are exposed to and how soon or whether they're exposed to crime. And
absolutely.
Mike, these are all issues that I think have a very strong racial component just by virtue of the fact that so much of the city is populated by African Americans, and I am completely, completely sensitive to that. But the distinction that I am making, and maybe it's a subtle one and I don't mean it to be, but the distinction that I'm making, that in terms of the role of the state's attorney, it's our job to prosecute individuals who commit crime. And more importantly, it is our job to prosecute violent criminals who are committing repeat violent offenses. And for those individuals who are first-time offenders and who have drug abuse issues and the like, to the extent that you can show me programs for intervention, treatment, the kinds of things that Mrs. Jessamy has talked about for the last 15 years, but frankly haven't really happened, but to the extent that she talks about it, I support those things. But issues of education and things you're talking about, I wholeheartedly agree. It's just not within the purviews of the state's attorney's office.
Greg,
so
can I
get in on this?
You can, but Shelley, I think in all fairness, what we have to do is...
Yeah, no problem.
Greg Bernstein, Pat Jessamy has just called in. We agreed to give everybody kind of equal time today.
Sure.
I want to thank you for being part of the show and good luck on election
day
tomorrow.
Thank you all. Thank you very much. Take care. Goodbye.
Take care. And now we are joined by State Attorney Pat Jessamy. And Sherlyn, I want you to come in on this as well. But Pat, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm well.
Hi, Mrs. Jessamy.
Hi, Mrs. Jessamy.
Now, how should we start this? This is so much juggling here. But Sherlyn, do you want to say something and let Pat Jessamy respond?
Well, maybe just to transition over.
Go ahead.
You know, I just think that what we just heard from candidate Bernstein was very interesting. And even the distinction that he drew, I think, was an important one. And I think I understood what he was saying. I also think, however, that it is not inappropriate to recognize that the responses of many of the actors within the criminal justice system that does fall under the purview of the state's attorney's office is also influenced by race. And I think it's important for, anyone interested in that office to be able to recognize and to be candid about those realities, too, as it relates to jurors and so forth. I wrote in the piece about, for example, the Able report that candidate Bernstein has cited numerous times. This was the report that said that, you know, in order to increase convictions, we needed to bring in jurors from Howard County and Montgomery County to try Baltimore City cases. Well, we could say that that's just a regional issue, but to pretend that there is not a racial dynamic that overlays that suggestion and that made people respond to the Able report in the way that they did would be silly. And so when candidate Bernstein then cites that report, it does produce a reaction. And this is what I'm saying are the places in which I think we do need to just frankly talk about where race does play into this, not in a way to suggest that race, you know, designates, you know, crime and punishment and how people fear crime, but to recognize that people's responses to our solutions do have something to do with race.
Pat Jessamy, State's Attorney, I'd like to hear your thoughts right now.
Well, you know, this campaign has, my opponent's campaign has not been about the truth. He keeps making statements that we have the lowest conviction rate in the state, and that is not true. And when I have presented numbers which show that we commit 60% to the Department of Corrections, even though we account for only 31% of crime, then no one really pays attention to that. That means that you're twice as likely to go to prison for having committed a serious crime in Baltimore City as you are in any jurisdiction in the state. Now, that means that people who commit serious crimes in Baltimore are going to prison, and they're serving lengthy sentences. Now, my opponent has also said that when I work in conjunction with the U.S. Attorney's Office, that I'm abdicating my responsibility as a prosecutor. That's working to make sure that violent criminals are taken off the streets. He came in initially and said he did not believe in prevention and intervention, and now he ascribes to it. So we want to know, what is the truth? Do you believe in prevention? Do you believe in intervention? Do you believe in treatment? Because a prosecutor's office must participate in order to have it happen.
We don't
run treatment programs. We refer to treatment programs. He knows that. Also, prosecutors are very well prepared in court. And if judges think that they don't present evidence, then all judges do would be to direct a verdict away from a jury.
Well, let me ask our other guests to come in here and ask some questions. And, Brian, we haven't heard from you, so Brian Griffiths, let me ask you to come into the conversation.
I mean, at this point, I'm a little confused there, just by your statement there about the priorities of the prosecution, the judges diverting it away from the jury.
It's a rule of law. If there is insufficient evidence, if we have not shown a case, and all it takes is a motion from a defense attorney to direct a verdict away from a jury, and a judge will find not guilty.
Well, let me, Ms. Jessamy.
If prosecutors are not presenting sufficient evidence, where a judge thinks that the evidence is so flawed that we have not overcome our burden.
Brian, did you have a question you were going to ask for that? Or, and then, because I know Anthony has one.
Anthony can go ahead.
That's fine.
Okay. Mrs. Jessamy, this is Anthony McCarthy. I want to ask you, Greg Bernstein mentioned in his presentation that there is a perception and that judges have said to him that it is the assistant state's attorneys, the presentation of their cases, which is the problem.
I think Mr. Bernstein is not telling the truth again. I do not believe that. I have not had judges to tell me that prosecutors are presenting flawed evidence to them. That is not true.
Okay. Why do you think, Mrs. Jessamy, and I know you can't control people's perceptions, but there is, and it seems like Greg Bernstein has been able to capitalize on this, there is a perception, and you just explained the conviction rate, but there is a perception that Baltimore has a problem with making convictions in the courtroom.
That because that is the media's stand. Mm-hmm. The truth is that we have the highest in the state when you look at serious crimes. You cannot have people committed to prison unless they have been convicted.
Very good point. Okay.
And that is a fact. Now, a conviction rate.
We also have the highest crime rate in the state, though.
And plead everybody out to time served, and nobody goes to prison. So if you're going to be talking about a conviction rate where no one goes to prison, then that may be what is happening in some of the other jurisdictions. But we account for almost two-thirds of the commitments, but we don't account for but 31% of all the crime. That tells the story, and that tells the truth. Also, we're experiencing in Baltimore City the lowest homicide rate we've experienced in 30 years. Now, that is the truth, too. We have too many murders, of course. One murder senselessly on our streets is one murder too many.
And
but the homicide rate has declined.
and it has declined. I mean, there's a lot of factors where it's declining. I mean, in the city that go across departments and all social kinds of issues as well, that means crime is going down. Does Sherilyn or Michael Johnson have a thought or question before?
But that's a point I want to raise, Mark, too, because I mean, the question is, if crime is going down and if the murder rate is going down, then we recognize it's multifactorial, and it means many things are coming to the table. That has to, of course, include, I would assume, the state's attorney's office. And so I really wanted to ask and suggest to me something about the prevention and treatment piece, which I'm very interested in and which you have talked about a lot in this campaign. You started to say something about it. What do you mean by that in terms of what the state's attorney does to connect addicts, criminal defendant addicts, with resources to get treatment, which is a huge problem in Baltimore City?
And let me just say, we only have 2 minutes.
Yeah. Well, we have a diversion program in our district court. Immediately, we have a 90-day drug treatment program, diversion program, a 90-day marijuana diversion program. We participate in drug treatment court at the district circuit and the juvenile level. We also participate in a program at the circuit court level that's run by the circuit court called the Felony Drug Initiative. In all of these initiatives, individuals are referred to drug treatment programs that exist in the community. Some of which they pay for themselves, others the state pays for.
But the question I would have, just in conclusion of that, would be, of the cases like that that are nonviolent drug offenses, what percentage of those cases do you request that people go to treatment, and what percentage of those cases go to trial, or do people serve time in jail while waiting trial for nonviolent offenses?
You and I have had this conversation before.
We have.
In terms of people being in jail awaiting trial on nonviolent offenses, if their bail is set at a higher rate, it's usually because they have failed to appear at other times. Most times, if it's a nonviolent offense, a judge will release someone on their own recognizance if they determine that they are not a threat to the community. Usually when judges set bails, a high bail, is because the individual had, at one point or another, failed to appear for their scheduled court date.
Well, say something. When I asked the spirit of that question was whether we're, majority of cases being recommended to go into a program instead of jail, are you seeking incarceration instead of treatment in most of those cases, is the question I
meant. Well, no. Incarceration for nonviolent offenders on an initial charge is usually not something that we request.
State's Attorney Pat Jessamy, we wish you luck tomorrow.
Good luck, Ms. Jessamy.
Well, thank you very much.
Good and luck. We'll see you on the other side of the polls closing.
Yes. We're having our celebration event tomorrow evening at the Rowing Club.
Well, good luck to you.
Good luck to
you. We look forward to seeing you right after that.
Thank you.
And Brian Griffiths, thank you so much for being with us on the phone. Michael Johnson, thanks for being in the studio with Anthony McCarthy and Mark Steiner and Sherilyn Ifill at the last minute. Thank you for calling in.
Thanks for letting me.
Thank you, Sherilyn.
And folks, we've got to take a very brief break and come back. When we come back, we are going to be joined by Ben Jealous, who is current president and CEO of the NAACP. Stay with us. Don't go away.